laws of slaves. There are many detailed laws mentioned in this chapter. Now, the scenario, when did this take place? If you recall from last week's Sedra, we spoke of the Kabbalah Satorah, the Seres Adibra, and we'll see in what perspective to try to picture what took place. The Sedra begins with Ve'ela HaMishpatim Asher Tosim Lifnehem. These are the statutes, and it goes into very mundane acts that will take place. Previous chapter speaks about the revelation that was witnessed, and then in the middle we have here Ve'ela HaMishpatim, and it goes into all kind of details concerning if you buy a male slave or a female slave, and then also the idea of social justice. There's a big part of that, and self-perfection, and a person staying away, as we'll see, from any taint of falsity or bribery and so forth. But in verse 24, in chapter 24, it says, "And to Moshe God said, ascend El Hashem. He said to Moshe, come up closer, you, Aaron, Nadav, Avihu, who were the sons of Aaron, and the 70 of the elders, v'ishtachavisem mirachok, and from the top of the mountain, when you're still from afar, you should prostrate yourself." Now, then it says in verse 2 that Moshe himself should come up unto God, but the rest of the people should remain back behind. The Ha'om and the general populace should not come up with him. Verse 3 says that Moshe came, told the people all that God had spoken, and all of the Mishpatim and all of the statutes. Yan Kol Ha'om, the people answered, Kol Echad, in one voice. The Yomru, and they said, Kol HaDvarim, all that which God has spoken, Naseh, we will do. Now, when it says that Moshe spoke to them, in verse 3, all the words of God and all the Mishpatim, what was he referring to? What does this mean? Now, Ve'ela Mishpatim, we said that's this week's chapter, the chapter that we're studying. So it means that Moshe told them all of these laws until this point. It says twice, though. It says, Vesaper La'om, Es Kol Divrei Hashem, all the words of God, and all of the social laws. We understand the social laws are Mishpatim, but what are all the words of God? And then Moshe proceeds to write this down. Vayichtev Moshe Es Kol Divrei Hashem. He wrote down all of that, which he had just spoken about, taught them. He wrote this in a book, and he gave them the Divrei Hashem. So he wrote part of the Torah. So here we have a part of the Torah being written. Now, how was this divided? So Hirsch has a very interesting interpretation, which seems, because there are different opinions, but his seemed to fit in very well with the text. He said the four chapters from 20 to 23 was dealing first act of giving the Torah. Starts out with the Aseres HaDibros. Vaydaber Elokim Es Kol HaDvarim Ho'ele. God spoke all of these words, saying, Anechi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God. And then we have the 10 Dibros. And then we go through, it tells us a number of laws, how to serve God. And then it goes into the Mishpatim. So these four chapters was the first part of the law giving. The last passage of chapter 23 speaks about letting the inhabitants of the land remain in Israel. It says that when you come into the land and you will inhabit the land, le'yeshvu be'artzecha, they shouldn't dwell in your land. Don't permit them to sit in your land, because they will cause you to sin. Kisavod esalehem, they will end up sinning and worshiping their gods, and that will be an obstacle to you. So that was the final verse of the Mishpatim, of that section, which is the first act of the law giving. Now, he is now going and speaking about a second phase of the giving of the law. So we now view the presence of all the people, gathered around Har Sinai to receive the Torah. Chapter 19, verse 24 was the passage immediately before the Ten Commandments. God said to Moshe then, "Go back, Lech Rei, you go down now and stand with the people. Moshe, you're now receiving the Aseres Hadibros, I want you to stand with all the people together. Afterwards, after I've spoken to the people, then you and Aaron and the Kohanim will come forward, the people to remain there." So now we're going to this one point, he says. Told there of the people who were fenced off away from the mountain, and they had been told again and again not to go up. Moshe and Aaron would be allowed to go up. Now, when the first Ten Commandments were given, like we pointed out, Moshe stood with everybody else. If you notice, in chapter 20, verse 19, that's at the conclusion of the Ten Commandments, there it says, God said to Moshe, "Come speak to the children of Israel. You have seen that which that God has appeared unto you." In that point, God spoke to Moshe directly. Moshe came a little closer than the rest of the people. He went closer to the clouds which surrounded the presence of the Shekhinah. The people remained in the distance. Just picture it again. They were all together for the Ten Commandments. Now the Ten Commandments had finished. So Moshe went a little bit closer to Hashem. And then Hashem told him, Kosomar losas. That really had to do with the recognition and the acceptance of the commandments, that there are no other gods, no appurtenances to God. This was told to Moshe as Moshe was standing a little bit further up towards the Shekhinah than the rest of the people. Then God also told him all of these mishpatim. Now he says, "You come up further into the mountain, and I want you to come up, and Aaron, and Nadav, and Avihu." Everybody would be at a certain phase, at a certain position. So what is the idea? What was the idea of limiting everyone, it seems, to where they can stand? We're orchestrating here. What is this idea of orchestrating, that Moshe comes all the way up? Nadav, Avihu, it says in verse 2 that you could come closer, only you, and they can't come close, because the idea was that when it came to Kabbalah Satorah, great detail was placed as to where the people should stand. They shouldn't come close. If they come close, they will exact terrible punishments will come on them, and so forth. What was the significance? So Hirsch pointed out there in great detail that by fixing the limits, the way the people could come, so he says there were two facts which differentiate the system of laws from all others. The idea was that to show that these laws were indeed supernatural, superhuman, it wasn't made by an individual. And when these laws were originally given, these laws were given to a people that were not yet prepared to receive this law. They weren't at the heights that they were able to receive the laws. But God was giving it not only to them, but he was giving it to the children of Israel for all future generations, hoping that they will ascend to that point. This is very clear. Chapter 19, God is first making the preparations to give them the Torah. That's where he tells them, go back to the people, let them sanctify themselves in 2 days to purify and wash their garments. For the third day, they should be prepared to receive the Torah. At the same time, make a boundary and say to the people, beware, do not go up into the mountain, don't even touch part of the mountain, because if you touch it, you will be guilty of a capital offense. And therefore, you have to be very careful. Whoever touches it will die before the blast of the shofar is heard that you could return. So then Moshe went down and he spoke to the people. The people made their preparations. Moshe brought them out, and what they saw was this beautiful sight, which was awe-inspiring. The mountain was full of smoke before the, and he saw the smoke going up, and the people became very just disturbed. They became shocked and so on. They began to shake, and then God began to speak to them. Fine. But to appreciate why they needed all of this preparation, let's look back a few verses earlier. Up to then, God told Moshe, I expect the children of Israel that they should be to me for a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, and I'm going to give you the Torah to give them. So Moshe came back to them, and he said, are you willing to receive the Torah, everything that God will command you? At that moment, they all answered, Yachdov together in verse 8, and they said, whatever Hashem commands us, we will do. Willingly, naseh, meaning before even hearing, a blank check, we will do whatever God says. What better response could there be? So it says, if you look at the text in verse 8, Vayoshav Moshe es divrei ha'om el Hashem. Moshe brought back the words of the people to God. A very positive response that all the people willingly are ready to undertake that which Hashem wants. Then in verse 9, God says to Moshe, I am going to come to you in the thickness of a cloud, Bavur Yishma Ha'om. All the people will be able to perceive B'dabri Imoch that I speak with you. They will hear me speak to you. And therefore, they will never question the authenticity of the revelation to you. And whenever you come and tell them a law, they'll willingly accept this law. So it says, Moshe immediately right there, Began b'chol yaminu la'olam, v'yageid Moshe es divrei ha'om el Hashem. Moshe said the words of the people to God. Which words? In verse 8, he just finished telling the words of the people, that the people said, Naseh, we will do everything that you want. Then in verse 9, God says, I'm going to come with a cloud, and they'll hear the voice of God speaking to you. And the same verse says, and Moshe told what the people said to God. What did he tell God? He just told them in the previous passage. In verse 8, he told them that they were willing to do everything. God just said to him in verse 9, I'm going to come to you, and they'll see me speak to you. So then it says right away, and Moshe told the words of the people to God. He just told them that. What words? So Hirsch says, very good interpretation. He says, Vayaged Moshe, he stretched out, like he set out, the words of the people to God, that which he said before. Telling God, the people are already in that level. They said, Naseh, they'll do everything you demand of us. There's no need for you to trouble yourself to make a divine revelation and to speak to me, to document I'm your messenger. The people already have reached the highest heights and they're willing to accept the entire Torah. So the Ben Shalom Vayagid Moshe. So then God answers him in verse 10. You got a long way to go yet. Leich el ho'om, he tells him. The people aren't there yet. Go to them. V'kidashtom hayeim u'mochor. They should prepare themselves. V'chipsusim losom. That means the fact that they were electrified this moment, that they're really they're jumping into the clouds, into the heavens, you know, and they've already made it, that's not really where they're at. And the proof is, we know that the Eagle came about shortly thereafter. They had a long way to go until they reached this. And Hertz says that this erroneous confidence of Moshe himself, that the people have already attained the spiritual and moral maturity, may make the meaning and necessity for the preparations and precautions so much clearer. All right? Because the idea was to make the people realize that it's not that easy. You just can't put on a capote and grow a beard and become a tzaddik. The idea is that there's a lot of work that goes in for the person perfecting himself and reaching that madrega. It doesn't come overnight and it doesn't come in a magic fashion. So he says, the object was and to establish for all times the great gulf that existed then between the spiritual and moral stage on which the people stood and the height to which the law they were yet to receive was destined to elevate and educate them through the course of centuries. This was the whole idea, that they should realize that they have a long way to go, but also that the idea was to realize that religion, and here he says a very important thing, especially for our generation, religion was not something that came from the people, but it came down to the people. It had to be a a visual teaching that here you have God speaking and the people hearing, the people listening. God would be standing against the people, opposite the people. He says, for the Jewish law is the only one that didn't emanate from the people, but Judaism is indeed the one religion that didn't spring, quoting from him, from the breasts of the men who found the basis of their lives, but it came from outside of man. So he says it's just this objectivity that makes it unique of its kind and differentiates it sharply from everything else on earth. And then he goes into a more detailed explanation. And he explains perfectly in three sentences what Reconstructionism is. I never really understood. I used to read and read, and I felt I was dense because I couldn't really appreciate the essence of this Reconstructionist movement. What do they mean? But Hirsch wasn't speaking about them, obviously, but he was speaking about religion and other religions. And he says, all other religions and laws emanate from the minds of contemporary humanity. They're nothing but the expression of, at a given time, a certain circle of human beings, at a given time, arrived as their conception and conviction of God, and what the mission of man is, what his relation to God and his fellow man should be. These people in that generation arrived to this understanding. Therefore, he says, all other religions and laws, like all other phases of culture, knowledge, art, morals, manner, which come from that generation of contemporary man, so we know art changes, everything else changes, morals change, we know that. This comes from contemporary society, so you don't have the same morality that you had in the first century that you do in the 20th century. I mean, it may be the same, but it's not necessarily the same. Because every century you have different ideas. Now, we see it happening in our day, in morality. I mean, it's just something that that develops. There's no question the last 40 years you've seen this change in morality. And how does it happen? It happens because people are exposed. For example, the media. The last 2 months, the media doesn't stop speaking about homosexuality. All the talk shows, all the programs, all the news programs, they just clobber away at you in a sense, so that breaks through the barriers and you have a new morality. The cars, for example. I remember when the smaller cars came out and I was driving the big cars, it looked so funny. But now when you see a big car, it looks funny. The small car is in. So the idea is that these change in the people's times. And in a century, of course, it changes. Now, religion, there are some that believe that's the same idea of religion. The religion that we have, and I happened to see it written the other day in a paper from an article, intellectual. The religion that we have, they believe that the religion, the ancient Jews, had their conception of God. There is a God, but their feelings and their understanding, they had according to what they understood, and they wrote it down in the Torah. But this is like a general, broad constitution for us. Basically, it was the expression of the religious belief of that generation. The Talmud is the expression of the religious belief of their generation, and we have an expression of the religious belief of our generation, and that becomes our religion. And that's what Judaism is. It's a reconstructionist religion, meaning that you could look at it like every generation, you'll reconstruct that which you believe are the ethical, moral principles of your time and that Jews should follow, taking into consideration, of course, their heritage and their background and so on. But just like art changes and everything else changes, religion also changes. So this is the idea, the way he writes it, that the degree of human... There's nothing but the adequate expression of the degree of human development reached at any particular time. But the Jewish religion did not emanate from contemporary convictions of human beings. They do not contain the convictions of any certain people at any certain time of what God is. All right? and what godly and human matters are. They are given by God and contain that which, according to the will of God, should be man's conviction in all ages. So this is very clear. And he said, in order to get this point across, we also had to have man standing there and receiving it from God. This had to be visible, that they should really understand that religion is something that they aspire to ascend to. And otherwise, it is not a contemporary form of service to God in the same way that you have contemporary art or contemporary music. You also have contemporary religion. Now, in essence, this is very clear. This is what especially the term Reconstructionism means. The others are liberalizing an ancient religion. Reconstructionism is starting, not liberalizing an ancient religion. There's a basic difference from conservative to Reconstructionism, or it used to be. Conservative is the idea that originally they would take the written law, not the oral law, then parts of the oral law, there was a broad understanding of the oral law, and it would all be filtered down. Reconstructionism, to a degree, is filtering up. That means society itself. The best idea would be the laws of compassion and mercy. A Jew, we'll see here, has to have compassion and mercy, especially in this week's Sedra. It speaks out very clearly about having compassion and mercy for the widow, for the orphan, for the convert, very strongly. Now, the question is, do you have compassion and mercy for the murderer? Do you have compassion and mercy for the degenerate? Do you have compassion and mercy for people who go violently, violate against the Torah, violate the laws of the Torah? The compassion and mercy go outward for them. So again, in Judaism, the Jewish trait of compassion and mercy, there's no question that that's our basic idea. But it's been taken by generations and interpreted that any, we'll say, minority or any movement or something which the masses seem to disagree with or sometimes limit the rights of this individual, so we as Jews have to have compassion and mercy for this movement, we'll say, for this idea, for this concept. And therefore, freedom of speech is a question of compassion or mercy. It's Jewish nature, so the ACLU, Civil Liberty Union, would be an expression of the Jewish concept of compassion and mercy. To let the Nazis go in Skokie, or, I mean, things, whatever it is, but that's the compassion and mercy of the second part of the 20th century. And now the idea of the immorality that we consider an abomination of what's going on now, this lifestyle, so that's compassion and mercy. Like I told you once, I had one of these men call me up and wanted me to, must be already 10 years, and he wanted me to back a law in Montgomery County or something that was dealing then with segregation against gays and so on. And I told him, I can't. So he became violent. He says, where's your mercy and your compassion, which is Judaism? I said, I do have mercy and compassion for you. I'll try to help you cure yourself if possible and so on. And he truly became violent. But the idea is, so does that mean, according to that, we Jews have to go in the forefront for freedom of abortion and homosexuality and all of these things because they're all liberal ideas and expression of people's concepts, and we were always for that. And that's the mode of this century. That's what forms this century. That becomes principles of our religion. Obviously, that's not what Judaism is. And we talk different than democracy, if you call that democracy. So democracy is not, we're not a democracy, we're a theocracy to a degree. The Torah regulates what democracy is. And it may not be the same as Washington and Jefferson if we say that that's their concept, because religion is not something that comes from the hearts of people. So this was an extremely important message. And therefore God said to Moshe, no, I insist that you go and you separate the people in that way. Now, even then, afterwards, getting back to, unless you want to discuss something that I've said, we'll continue in this. All right, getting back at this moment, getting back to 24. He says to Moshe, I want you now for the rest of the time, you're supposed to come forward. But the others, they haven't reached your level yet. Aaron and the others will stand a little bit further back. Aaron and the others will stand a little bit further back. And Moshe did that which God told him in verse 1. But before it said, Moshe himself should come forward. Now in verse 3, before he did this next act, he came back and he taught them all about Mishpatim and all that which God had told him from after the Ten Commandments until this one point. And he wrote all of this down. He got up in verse 4 in the morning. He built an altar underneath the mountain. And there were 12 matzevos for the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, there's a very important point of the 12 matzevos. All of the Jews were standing there. So what does he have to build monuments? They were really all there. It was in front of all the people. So why did he go and build the matzevos? So Hirsch explains this idea. The idea was that it wasn't speaking only for the Jews that were there at that time. These 12 tribes were present, he says, so there was no reason to represent them symbolically. So it wasn't the 12 tribes that were actually there at that time, but the whole future of Israel. The 12 matzevot relates to the future 12 tribes throughout history, children of Israel, all the generations. And God then made with them, they brought sacrifices, and then Moshe made a pact, meaning a covenant. In verse 6, he took half of the blood and he put it in basins. And half of the blood he spilt on the altar. So the idea was, he then took the blood in verse, and he read to the people, if you notice the order, and he then read to the people this book of the covenant, as much as he had written, only up to here. He didn't have the entire Torah yet. And the people again said, Naseh v'nishma, we will do and we will hear. Now the implication of the word, we will do and we will hear. Remember in Yisro, we always quote Naseh v'nishma. In Yisro, it just said Naseh then. Here, they're really saying Naseh v'nishma. So the idea was, Hirsch says, receiving the verbal transmission, for it also said Naseh. In verse 3 here, it said, it's called Vayan kol ha'om kol echod v'yomru, a few sentences before, kol ha'dvorim asher diber Hashem Naseh. So Hirsch explains it the following. In verse 3, on receiving the verbal transmission, it was sufficient to vow Naseh. Why? Because the law had already been explained to them in all its details and meanings. So that, all they had to promise was to carry it out, to do it. So then when Moshe explained them in verse 3, he taught them all the laws, the oral law, interpreting all of these passages. So they said, fine, we understand it, Naseh, we will do it. Now Moshe wrote it into the book, part of the Torah, and he gave them that. Now the oral law was not written because it was an oral law. So really what was written? It was only written the text that we have it. It was written the text in its short, basic formula as we have the Torah before us today. They weren't, the detailed meaning and the explanation remained for the verbal teachings. So then here, when they're receiving the text, they just don't say, Naseh, we will do, because the text itself doesn't make sense. You have to have the written and the oral law. Therefore, they said, Naseh, we will do, v'nishma, and we will listen, we will learn to be able to understand what is written in this text. So according to this, they received this much of the Torah. And then in verse 8, it says, he threw the blood on the people, and he says, this is the blood of the covenant. So Hirsch says very nice, the idea of throwing some blood on the altar and then the blood on the people. So he says this expresses the idea that every drop of blood, every ounce of our forces that we give up to carry out Hashem's will on earth is given back to us in the full measure that we give it to God. So he says this is the idea that whatever we give to Hashem, so that will be given back to us. And this is the covenant that we made with Hashem. The rest of the Sedra says that They then, Moshe and Nadav Avihu, in verse 7-9, ascended to the mountaintop. They saw the God of Israel under his feet. There was Livnas HaSapir. They saw this view, whatever that meant. And to the elders, those that were not worthy of such a view, so they really were inspired by God, but they didn't really reach the levels that Moshe and Aaron reached. And then in verse 12, God says, come up to me and I will give you the written 10 commandments. So verse 13, Moshe and Yehoshua rose and went up, and Moshe himself went up to the mountain. The elders remained near there. The mountain, then the clouds came down in the mountain for 40, it covered the mountain for 6 days. Moshe was there. The seventh day, he ascended further into the heavens, and Moshe was in the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. So this was the second part of the Kabbalah Satorah, which then was given to Moshe. But it was important, it seems, to choose till chapter 24 the many social laws that are written. In the end of Yisro, there are a few important laws about idolatry, the ideas, you know, that were very important as an attachment to the Ten Commandments itself. But after that, immediately, they went to Elam Mishpatim. Now, that really is quite a drop, if you will. What is the Mishpatim? There are all kinds of Mishpatim. They deal like with traffic tickets. I mean, if you're dealing here about the celestial heights and so on, and you see God, and everything is so terrific, inspired, and you're dealing with idolatry and allegiance to Hashem, all of a sudden, we consider it important enough that they should know right away and accept in this covenant before they go further the laws of goring an ox, goring someone else, or the other social laws that are mentioned in this sedra. So that itself is a very important lesson, that Judaism wasn't meant just to be a religion, you know, that is an intellectual religion, that philosophical, but Judaism was much more down to the level, and for a person to perfect himself. Why should a person perfect himself? Because he is God's concern. Indeed, that's the meaning of the first of the commandments. The first of the commandments is, I am God that took you out of Egypt. It's not enough to believe I'm a creator of the world. We have to believe that I am God who is concerned for every aspect of your development, for your well-being. So if that's true, so God concerns himself for the traffic tickets, for the misdemeanors, just as well as felonies, and for the more aggravated cases of a perversion of justice. The same idea. But if you take apart the beginning of Mishpatim, you have a very important lesson there. It starts out with an Eved Ivri. Now, they say that if God wanted, the curse said, if this was written by a man, or we have to understand, even if it was given from Hashem, why did they pick Eved Ivri? Why didn't they pick the chapter here which deals about lending people money without taking interest? That would be a very nice idea to start out a... Why did they worry about Kisikne Eved Ivri Sheish Shonim Ta'avod? If you steal and you purchase a guy that stole Eved Ivri, he has to go for 6 years. In the seventh year, he goes out free and so on. We would think that that law has to be written, but it didn't have to be in the first paragraph or in the first page. Now, various commentaries discuss this and make comments on this point. It's a very important point. Hirsch has his approach, but there's a very interesting approach from the one of the Balei Musar, Kisik Neved Ivri, Reb Simcha Zissel Kellum, who wants to say, if the Torah would be given by man, there's no question, he says, that it would start speaking about the great deeds of kindness and benevolence and so on. But since, he says, the whole idea of the commandments was that we are God's children, Boni Matem Lashem. Now, if a person has a son who is a ganef amongst his children, So all his concerns really are given up to this son, who's the gun, and he tries to see how to defend him and how to take care of him and so on, because out of his concern. If it's somebody else, you say, Raganov, I don't want to have to do it again. But if it's your own son, so then that occupies your total mind, your total concentration. You have to get him a good defense attorney. You have to look after his welfare. After your original, we'll say, your original disappointment, disillusionment, and so on, but you say, but he's still my flesh and blood. I have to represent him. I have to give him strength. I have to be with him. So therefore, he says, what occupies the minds of Hashem? How you will take care of the Ganef. So therefore, because the Ganef is still a child of God. So he looks for Eitzes, that when you get this Ganef, so the Torah wants to tell you how he should be taken care of. And the phenomena is that when you study the Torah judicial system, or the Torah penal system, you see how, we'll say, progressive, more progressive than we can appreciate in our generation. On one hand, you will say, yeah, but it's cold. It believes in capital punishment. You know, capital punishment and corporal punishment, all of these things are not democratic and not progressive. The idea of killing a person, you know, against the death penalty, that's something that, again, all liberal people are against the death penalty. And the Torah will say is medieval in the sense that it's backwards, it's ancient, it's not progressive. Yet, when you look at the different points, you'll see how progressive they are. You know, there were no Lorton seminaries. There were no Lorton's prisons, right, in the Torah. They didn't have this whole idea of putting a person into prison as a warehouse, a human warehouse. That wasn't there. If the person killed, if he committed a capital offense, so the din is uviata ramikir becha, you get rid of him. But if the person did not commit a capital offense, but the idea is that he stole, let's take that as an example. So, and he can't make restitution. So what are you going to do with him? You'll put him into to jail. He'll sit there a number of years, and then he'll go out again and steal again. He didn't learn anything. He's underprivileged. He's socially deprived. And he's going to go back into the same environment, into the same atmosphere. They didn't hold that would be a proper punishment or would be a worthwhile endeavor. So therefore, they said that this person, Besdin, will sell him. And when they sell him, they will sell him, you could call it a slave. But the human rights that were protected, or the civil rights that he had, I mean, we're all familiar that whatever the master had, he had to have. And the master can't eat steak and give him chopped meat. They have to have the same food. The master has a pillow, kitev le'imach. He's almost like part of the family. He sees what a family looks like. He is working for him, he gets a trade, he gets this. He develops a certain morality, a certain honesty, integrity. And therefore, in a sense, that was a process of rehabilitating him. And after the 6 years, when he goes out, after 6 years, when he graduates his course, you don't just go ahead and send him out, but hanek tanek lei mitzenko, you have to give him quite a bit to help get going in life. And you have to give him certain amounts of whatever you were blessed and prospered through his labor. And now, at least, there's a person going out with something, possessing something, having lived in a home, and so on. You could say that there is this rehabilitation. So this was really the prison system. There were no prisons per se. The only time you see somebody was locked up were in isolated cases, till he would be brought to the Besdin perhaps, and so on. Or during the years, the governments themselves had to invoke, for whatever reason, their own prison system. But according to Torah law, we don't find this idea of a prison. So much so, to even go further, and this week said, we know if you steal, or you go ahead and steal an ox and you slaughter the ox and sell it, you have to pay five times. A sheep, so you only have to pay four times as much. Why? Because it says, since this poor Ganef had to carry the sheep, right? So it was difficult for him to carry an ox or whatever it is, you just leave. But the sheep won't go, so he had to carry the seah. So therefore, we give him off a little bit for the harshness, you know, difficulty, the tsar that he had when he was stealing. Now, this can only be by a father and a mother. Another person would say, Ganef, who told him to steal? I mean, so he stole, so I mean, so we have to give him up. But a father and mother would say, oh, never. He stole, yeah, but look how he had to work. I mean, you know, it's a total, he had to schlep it on his. So Mamela, the father and the mother would also show this so-called compassion and feeling for the tsar. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu in that way also shows his ahava, his love, even for the ganef, in the sense that he took into consideration that which the ganef suffered. And this documents, so now when we'll speak about the system of justice, right? Is it a harsh, medieval, ancient type of justice? Or perhaps it's progressive far beyond the 20th century. I think that this is, I mean, you read every so often, you know, experts, penal experts, they try to speak about what the perfect judicial or, you know, the system of judgment and punishments and penal system, what it should actually be. And you always see, they say it should be rehabilitated rather than what we have now. And you see this whole concept in the Torah. Every aspect of the law has to be fulfilled because he knows the makeup of an individual and how this would be effective. You can't just take the concept, you have to follow all the details. And the details are what brings about the fulfillment. But at the same time, we see that the idea is not, the idea should be rehabilitating someone. It's just a thought that is worth knowing, that God is concerned really for the individual.